Hello and welcome to the Golden Thread Conversations. I'm your host, Judy Murdoch. Today, our guest is Larissa Noonan. Larissa Noonan is a teacher, healer, and ritualist. She helps witchy healers who grew up in fundamentalist homes heal from the scars of a right-wrong mindset so they can be their authentic selves and bring their witchy healing gifts fully into their communities and the world. To learn more about Larissa, you can visit her website, larissanoonan.com. So Larissa, you were my very first guest on the Golden Thread Conversations, and I'm really happy to have you back.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be back. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. So I've seen like a shift, or I think more accurately, more like it feels like a refinement in what you are offering and, you know, in your work. So I think although the overall nature of your work has not shifted, you know, I do see sort of more of a refinement. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, the work that you're doing this year. And just share a little bit about, I like the new metaphor that you're using to explain the challenges that your clients might be experiencing and how you help them.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I guess I would start by saying that over the past year, my work has become more refined, or the way I speak about it has become more refined. I think that's an accurate word. Previously, I was more talking about my work in terms of helping people heal the wounds of the past through ancestral lineage healing, helping people become more embodied and present in their bodies with whatever is arising in their bodies in relation to past trauma or what's actually happening even in the moment, and helping with boundaries as well. And not boundaries that are rigid or that are so much, just to keep things out so that we can stay in our safe little world, but boundaries more in the sense of being in relation to the world and to the energies around us in a way where we still have agency and we have choice and we have this and we are able to practice discernment.
I think that's a really, really good distinction.
Yeah, thank you.
So thanks for that. Yeah, it's really good.
And then over the past year, I've been starting to narrow in or starting to define who I work with more specifically. You know, what I was just describing is more what I did. And I've started to become clear about who I work with. And thank you for your introduction. You spoke to that clearly. I'm working more and more specifically with people who are witchy healers. And what I mean by that is people who are connected with the earth, who when they look around, they see that there is life everywhere. It's not just humans, other living humans who we can be in relationship with who are alive. They walk into the forest and the trees are alive to them, the birds are alive to them, the earth is alive, and they are able to be in relationship with all these other than human people, with our other than human kin. And they want that and they see the necessity of that and the importance of that and that sense, and they crave that sense of belonging and that sense of being part of something larger that comes from being in relationship with more than just other than living humans. So that to me is what it is to be witchy. It's somebody who holds that larger perspective. A healer to me is somebody who's on a healing journey. When we are on our healing journey for ourselves, that naturally extends to the world around us. And so when I say healer, I don't necessarily mean that they are people who are doing something that you would think of as healing work, like maybe being a doctor or a massage therapist or a naturopath or an acupuncturist or an energy worker. They might be an artist or they might be a stay-at-home mom. But what is important is that they are seeking to to know themselves, to be in relationship with themselves that is loving, that allows them to access more integrity, more wholeness, and that allows them to be in a more loving relationship with the world around them as well.
You know, like one thing that I think about when you were describing the idea of the healer is that when we are on a healing journey, it just follows naturally that we ourselves become a more healing presence in the world.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because I, for a moment there, I was thinking to myself, well, I'm on a healing journey, but I don't know if I would call myself a healer. And so that was that occurred to me that, you know, just by putting energy and effort into healing and wholeness, you know, I myself, it changes my energy and the way I am present in the world.
Exactly. And it changes what comes through your art as well. When you're in that place of feeling pleasure and joy as you're creating your art, people feel that when they look at it. And so that naturally is a healing moment for people. It can change if somebody who is in more of a depressed or an anxious state, and they look at your paintings and they feel that joy and that pleasure that you experienced as you created it, it can shift their experience in that moment. That's a healing moment.
That's cool. I like that.
And so I don't know that it's important that we identify as healers ourselves. It's more just this idea that as we become more whole, we also allow that for others.
Right. So like any person can be a healer.
Absolutely.
It's part of our human, just part of what comes with our humanity.
Yes.
I like that.
Yes. Thank you. Cool. And then to speak to the final piece of that, of the introduction, the fundamentalist background. I grew up in a evangelical Christian community. My parents left when I was about 13. And so I know, you know, from lived experience, and not only, I know from lived experience what it is to grow up in a community that's very rigid, that has all these rules where you have to conform. And if you don't conform, you will be punished in some way, you know, perhaps through maybe you will be ostracized. Perhaps you will actually be excommunicated or kicked out of the community. Perhaps you will just have to sit down and have a talk with the deacons, who are, of course, you know, all men. And for a woman especially, probably for anyone, but speaking for myself, that would be pretty intimidating.
Yeah.
And not only that, but who grew up in a community where everything is split into this binary of right and wrong, good and bad, devil and God, sinner, saint, and where there's judgment alongside that binary, where the binaries aren't just on a spectrum. One is definitely better than the other. You want to be good. You don't want to be bad. In the community that I grew up in, you would want to be a man versus a woman because they have a lot more power.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera. And so this, you know, growing up in a community like that sets up a lot of patterns that need to be dismantled. And there's a lot of healing that can happen around those patterns, because even after we leave these communities, those ways of viewing the world and are still imprinted in our nervous system. So even if we're not still within that community, those patterns tend to replay through our lives in different ways that often lead to us not being able to really bring our gifts into the world in the way that we would want to.
Mm-hmm. So that feels like a really good segue into this metaphor of, you know, pollution and fog and, you know, kind of how these things, how the trauma of the fundamentalist culture and upbringing, like how those would affect somebody's life, you know, and their ability to bring their gifts into the world and be whole. So can you speak to that metaphor more?
Yes. So you're referring to a blog post that I wrote that's called The Five Smokestacks of Trauma. And it's it's laying out this metaphor that I'm hoping will help people understand kind of just the waters that we're swimming in and why it can be so hard to heal and so hard for these, to dismantle or to transform these patterns that are kind of shackling us.
Yeah. And I think like this thing that you said, may I just interject for a second?
Oh, yeah, please.
Okay. Okay. What comes up for me when you said that was this idea that it's not that there is a lack of self-help material in the world. You know, there's a lot, all kinds of modalities of coaching and, you know, just all kinds of things that are out there to help people become more, I think, you know, maybe more themselves or to become a person or to which they aspire. And at the same time, you can do all those things. I've done so many of those things and they're kind of helpful. You know, they give you some really help. They may give you some helpful ideas and inspiring ideas, but I know for myself, that was not enough for me. It was sort of like, it addressed kind of some superficial issues, but it never really addressed sort of the core. What was really happening? That was, you know, like it's that thing where you say, like, I know better and I'm still doing it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I thought I was done with this, but here it is again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So maybe I should back up just a little bit before I jump into this metaphor. And let me offer this premise that fundamentalism, which it is a way to deal with unresolved trauma. So all of these rules and this black and white thinking that can result, that are hallmarks of fundamentalism, are ways of attempting to exert control, to reestablish safety in response to those feelings of helplessness and fear and grief that are part of unresolved trauma.
Yes.
So in that case, fundamentalism would be something that comes over generations of unresolved trauma, which is how this ties into the ancestral healing work that I do as well. So here we are now in the present, and we have these things that we want to do in our lives, whatever they may be, and we find that we're struggling. And we are kind of lost in this fog of confusion, of directionlessness, purposelessness, perhaps pain, perhaps chronic pain, perhaps broken relationships, you know, just whatever the fog is for us. And so what this metaphor of the smokestack seeks to do is provide context for this fog that we're living in that makes it so difficult for us to heal and to be our authentic selves and to really bring our gifts into the world. Mm-hmm. So what is this fog or these smokestacks? And I'm using fog as a metaphor for all the unresolved trauma that surrounds us.
Okay.
And there's two different pieces to this. First, there's kind of just the naturally occurring fog of life. Even when there's no trauma, even when all of the trauma has resolved and our lives are like flowing along beautifully, there's still going to be some fog in our lives. And I think of that as being where the world of the seen world, like our 3D tangible world, meets the unseen world, the world of spirit. So that's where those sacred encounters happen. At that edge between our world and the unseen world. And so there's that's where magic is, that's where mystery is. There can also be risk there because we can get lost there too. And it's not just loving forces in the unseen world, it's just like there aren't just loving forces here in the seen world. And so, you know, there is some risk in just the natural fog of life, but it's also what brings mystery and magic and healing and you know, encounters with the divine. So that's fog, as to be distinguished from smoke that comes from these smokestacks, from these five different sources of trauma that I talk about in this article. So maybe I'll interject with a little story here about how this metaphor came to be. Last September, there were, as you may remember, there were massive fire wildfires over here on the West Coast, over. And there was a really huge one just like 15 miles from where I live in Oregon. And we were staying with some friends. We left our house because the fire was getting closer and closer to the town where we lived, and went to stay with some friends who very kindly took us in. And we were with them for about 10 or 12 days while the fires were happening. The air quality was so bad, you couldn't go outside. It was off the charts on all the indexes for hazardous air conditions. And I remember looking up every morning and waking up every morning and looking out the window. And every morning there was just, you couldn't even hardly see across the street because there was so much smoke in the air.
Wow.
And then there was a morning when there was also fog, like natural fog intermixing with the smoke. Mm-hmm. And it was the weirdest experience to look out and like see the moisture and also see all the smoke and the air pollution that was intermingling with the natural fog.
Wow.
And that got me thinking about how there is like fog is a part of life, and it's a beautiful part of life. And when you're walking through fog, it can be an incredibly magical and beautiful experience. Mm-hmm. But when the smoke is intermingling with the fog, it becomes toxic, and it becomes a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where this metaphor comes from.
Oh, that's cool.
So what are these different sources of smoke? And these are the five smokestacks that I've come to. And this aren't necessarily all of them, but these are just the five that I personally work with in my work with people and for myself. And so the first one is just naturally occurring trauma. And this is just part of the risk of being alive. Mm-hmm. Being alive, living here in a world where we have these physical bodies is a risk. There's risk to being alive. And that's as it should be. I believe that in some ways we incarnate into this world to have an adventure, and risk is part of an adventure.
Yep.
And so this is just, trauma is just a facet of life. We're going to have times when something happens that is traumatic. How we heal and how we handle that trauma is determined by a lot of things. And that's a whole nother topic that I would love to talk about sometime, but right now I'll just keep it to the smokestacks. So there's natural trauma. Another smokestack would be personal trauma. And this is just what happens as a result of us being alive in these bodies. So natural trauma would be more like things that happen.
Like the fires, right?
Like fire, exactly. Like fires, like floods, like hurricanes, like famine. Different things like that happen on more of a larger scale, mm-hmm. but that are just a result of living on Earth. Mm-hmm. Personal trauma is what happens in my personal life. So maybe I was neglected when I was a child. Maybe I was abused. Maybe I broke my leg falling off out of a tree. All these different things that we accumulate just through living. Mm-hmm. That's personal to us. Mm-hmm. And again, not everything that happens to us that could be considered trauma ends up being unresolved trauma that continues to play out in our lives and in our nervous systems. We can heal from trauma. I'm not at all saying that anything bad that happens to us is not possible to be resolved even in the moment that it happens, because so many things happen to us that we just actually shake off and move through and it's all fine.
Right.
What forms the smoke is the stuff that we're not able to shake off. Mm-hmm. And that continues to accumulate within our nervous systems and our bodies over time. Mm-hmm. So then the third smokestack is ancestral trauma. And this is the trauma that happened in the lives of our ancestors that was unresolved within their lives. And mm-hmm. then is passed on to the next generation and just compounds going on down through the generations until it reaches us.
Right.
So it's like this snowball effect of trauma that eventually comes into us. And so we're not just surrounded, it's not just our personal lived experience of trauma in our nervous systems. It's also our ancestors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you want to give an example of what ancestral trauma might be?
Sure. It could be just as simple as as someone falling out of a tree and breaking their leg and maybe being ridiculed for that, or it not healing correctly, or them not receiving the care that they need, and it not being something that can just be like a childhood event that they healed from and got over. Mm-hmm. But all these things compounding on, and then it flows to the next generation, and maybe the next generation has some accident as well that is also not unresolved, or that has all these things attached to it as well. And then it starts to become a repetitive pattern throughout the generations where there's these strange accidents.
Oh, interesting.
From generation to generation. This is something that plays out in father's line, for example.
That is very interesting.
Repeating random traumatic accidents where they don't receive the healing and the care that they need.
That is very interesting. And another example that comes to mind for me is, you know, either being oppressed or being the oppressor.
Absolutely.
So if your ancestors were slaves, or if they were, you know, the people responsible, you know, there's trauma experienced, you know, on both sides, like in both sides.
Yes. Yes. And that's getting actually into the next smokestack. But before I go there, other examples of like ancestral trauma would be like patterns of abuse going through the generations, whatever form the abuse takes. It could be addictions. It could be, you know, just fail, you know, repeating broken relationships or broken homes. Pretty much anything within the human experience that repeats throughout generations could be part of ancestral trauma.
Okay.
So yeah, then the fourth smokestack here is what I call cultural trauma. And this,
okay, yes,
yeah,
please.
Go ahead, please.
Nope.
Okay.
My question resolved in my mind.
Okay, awesome. So this smokestack refers to the pain or the suffering that results when living in cultures that have systems that are based in oppression, like you were saying, or based in dominance and control, or patriarchy, or colonization, or fundamentalism, or superiority, racism, capitalism, et cetera. So cultural trauma, it's kind of, we move from the personal, then we move to the ancestral, and then cultural would be like the kind of the even bigger ring. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just within the family system anymore. It's what our family systems experienced as a result of living in whatever culture they happened to be living in at the time. Mm-hmm. And like you were saying, a lot of our lineages lived through a time when they were being oppressed in some way, or maybe where they were the oppressor at another time. And so this is just kind of another bigger layer that we are swimming in. Is there anything else that you would want me to say about that? I know it's a really big topic.
It is a big topic. I think everybody understands culture perhaps like on a more intuitive level. Yeah. And I think too with culture that culture is something I think it's like, it's our environment, our like, I don't know, I would call it like, it feels to me like just a kind of these, like a frame to see the frame through which we see the world. So the beliefs we have, like, and I think it comes down to beliefs, sort of beliefs of like, this is how things work. And there are like different frames, like one frame is very fundamentalist and very much about very patriarchal.
Yeah.
That, you know, there is a strong man who is in charge of, you know, like things are to be run by strong, superior men. And if you are obedient, you will be rewarded. If you are not obedient, then you will be punished in different ways. And it may be from other people, but it could just be that you're poor, you know, or you're just, you're somebody in a caravan coming from Central America because your country is so violent. And it leads to this sort of idea. And I think this is very much, I think this is like a very strong part of our culture, American culture, is this idea that like, if you are living a life where bad things are happening to you, or you're just in a bad situation, it's your fault. Because for whatever reason, you know, like somehow you were disobedient, or you aren't like the group that's in power right now. It's so insidious. I think we've all become so much more aware of how insidious this culture is. So I think that was the only thing I wanted to add, is just that there are frames, like a culture to me is like kind of a frame through which we understand our world and understand, you know, why things happen and why we should do things.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you for bringing that in. Yes, thank you. Yeah, and that leads into my fifth smokestack, which is basically what you were just talking about, which is the fundamentalist upbringing. And I would say that it's quite likely that if you grew up in a Western culture, that culture is based in fundamentalism in some way.
Yeah, I agree.
That lens that you're looking through of right and wrong again, of this being the one truth, of again, men being superior, women not so much, of this race being superior, the other not so much, because all this comes back to that idea of this is right and this is wrong, this is good and this is bad. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
go ahead.
No, that was it.
Yeah, so my fifth smokestack is kind of just a nuance on the cultural ones, narrowing in specifically on fundamentalism, because that is my background. That's what I have the most experience with. And I want to make the suggestion, or I want to make or point to the possibility that just being raised in a fundamentalist home or a fundamentalist culture is traumatic.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that something really big happens that's easily to identify as the source of why things feel so fucked up in our world.
Right.
It's more that confusing and insidious, what you might call drip, drip form of trauma, where we are never really seen for who we are. We are expected to be a certain way or only one way. And if we're not that way, then again, we're in danger in some way.
Right.
And we are asked to repress our natural curiosity. It's not okay to have questions. We're asked to repress our instincts and our intuition. And we're actually told that we can't trust our bodies. We can't trust our inner knowing. And we have to be always seeking external validation.
Yeah. So it's sort of like fundamentalism, like what I'm hearing is it in a way, it cuts you off from huge parts of what makes us human. Because being human is so messy, you know, that's one of the things I kind of like about being human in a way, is just that it's not black and white. It's all gray. It's all on a continuum.
Yeah. It might not even be gray. It might be like full color.
Yeah, for sure. So Larissa, can you speak a little bit to, and specifically to fundamentalism, since this is kind of a focus of your work, what is an example or two of what it is like for an adult who has grown up in a fundamentalist home or community, and I'm assuming they're not part of that community anymore, because otherwise they wouldn't be coming to you probably. Exactly. And what kind of help do they need? What are different things that you help them with?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that I help them with is actually becoming embodied. And this goes back to the what I do that I talked about at the beginning. Because fundamentalism cuts us off from our bodies. It teaches us actively to distrust our bodies, that our bodies are sinful.
Right.
And so that's a huge piece of the healing from this, is actually beginning to trust ourselves and to trust our bodies again, and to trust that when we are around someone and when our bodies are feeling contracted, that maybe actually they're not a good person for us to be around. You know, I remember growing up and being a little girl and being around certain elders in the church where I did not feel safe and I wanted to leave and I did not want to talk to them. And my mom would be like, no, they're a good person. They're fine. You know, go talk to them. And I would want to just run away. And I learned through that experience of my mom, who was the authority telling me that my natural instincts were wrong, to override my own natural instincts and to believe what I was told.
Yeah.
And that sets up this incredibly painful, or it has been for me, this incredibly painful pattern within myself where I tend to trust what people say versus what I feel. And learning to actually trust what I feel versus the words that I'm hearing or what some external source is telling me has been a really long process. Very rewarding process, but it's a process I'll be working with for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Undoing that trust of others versus trust of myself.
Yeah.
So that's one example. Another thing that we work with is trusting our intuition, which comes again with trusting our body, because as I experience intuition is in our bodies, held in our bodies. And so if we're not in our bodies and we're not able to feel the messages or hear the messages that our bodies are giving us, we're not going to be able to, it's going to be much more difficult to trust the intuitive aspects of ourselves too.
So how would you define or make a distinction with intuition? Because I often find intuition is one of those ideas that it's a little blurry in the way that our culture uses it. Like, how would you, is it emotions? Is it thoughts? What is it?
Good question. Yeah. I think of intuition as it can come in many forms. Maybe for some people, it is that visual sense of they see something. Uh-huh. And for a lot of my clients are fairly visual, but they'll be like, okay, say we're doing some work, some ancestral healing work. And the ancestral healing work is, as you know, Judy, it's a lot about being able to trust the messages that you're receiving. And you could be receiving these messages in a lot of different ways. And one of them might be, you might actually like have some vision or see something and you'll be like, oh, I'm just making that up and want to discount it instead of being able to receive it. And even if it's maybe not 100% accurate, we're not going for 100% accuracy here, but instead of being able to be like, well, it might actually be something here for me. Maybe what I'm seeing actually has a message for me, and there is something real here. Some of my clients are more auditory and they actually receive messages through hearing things within, you know, just, it's like another voice in their head or voices in their head. And this is another valid way that intuition or that sensing or receiving information that's not coming from our five tangible senses can show up for us.
You know, what I'm thinking, Larissa, the way intuition often shows up for me is just a knowing.
Yes.
It could be something along the lines of meeting a person, you know, never met them before, don't really know very much about them at all, but just getting what I would call a really strong sense about them. And it might be something like, you know, this is just like somebody who's really angry and I have no idea what they're angry about specifically. I have no data, no evidence, you know, there's no, like, I can't, like, if somebody said, how do you know this guy's angry? You know, I would just say like, it's just the vibe I'm getting from this person.
Yes.
But it is a really strong, for myself, it is strong. It's very strong and I do trust it. At the same time. Yeah.
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I'm curious, like when you have that sense of, oh, this is just a really angry person, does that show up for you in some way in your body? Or is it just kind of like,
it's a thought.
How does that knowing arrive for you?
It's just like a thought.
It's just a thought. Okay.
I guess like the way, like, you know, I think our brains are usually working really hard to take in a variety of, you know, stimuli from our environments, from people. You know, it could be there. I mean, I think a big chunk of intuition is really physical. It's like from our, you know, like our really ancient human selves who are pre-verbal human selves, you know, who were not yet able to perhaps even use language. It's just sort of this, just kind of a knowing. And as I said, the thing I myself am cautious with is I trust the knowing, but I'm super careful about attributing like any kind of cause or reason to it. Or attributing a motive to it. So it's sort of like just knowing like, hey, this is an angry person. And when I'm with people who are angry and they kind of seem to have this free floating anger around them, I get really nervous and cautious. It brings up this caution in me because I really do feel a little bit like they're like, you know, they're like there's like a loose trigger there, and I'm not sure what's going to pop their trigger, but that makes me a lot more like just cautious in my dealings with them, because my feeling is like, I do not want to be the person who sets off the bomb.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that is like another sort of fundamentalist thing, because people are always sort of holding in their, you know, natural proclivities in unhealthy ways. And at various times they just let loose.
Yes. Oh, there's so much stuff to respond to there, but I'm going to try to keep it to one thing though. And I'm hearing is you receive this knowing that you hear kind of in your mind, but you're also feeling it in your body through that sense of nervousness and caution.
Yeah.
And
like danger, like that's what the danger, like if I had to like put like just one word on it, I definitely have that sort of that, you know, like fight or flight response of like danger, danger, danger. You cannot be yourself. You cannot be like use caution. You're in perilous territory here.
Yes. And so exactly. And so in my experience, from my background, fundamentalism would tell me that I can't trust what my body is saying or what I'm hearing about this person. Instead, I have to look at them and, oh, they're smiling and their words are just fine. So that must be the truth.
Yeah.
And so, right, you know, what you're sharing here is so perfect, because you're demonstrating how you're listening to your intuition versus what is actually being shown.
Right.
The way that you can actually, you know, and the way that you can see with your five senses or experience with your five, you're listening to your intuition. You're saying, yeah, this person is, his words are fine. Maybe he's even smiling, but I'm having this other experience and I am trusting this other experience that I'm having.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, intuition can show up in all these ways that you're describing. You can just know about it. You can feel these things in your body. You can have just a direct download around all of a sudden, all these details about something that weren't there before. You just now know. You can feel like emotions, like you're describing there, all of a sudden you're feeling kind of afraid.
Yeah.
And that you're recognizing that you need to be very cautious because you don't want something to explode.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying then about this particular piece for people is that one part of healing is just for them to become aware again. What, you know, the sensations of their physical bodies.
Yes.
And also to become aware of like any input that's coming in whatever form it takes to become just to tend to their emotions and to respect, like to give them respect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, when we're talking about trauma, sometimes the way what we're feeling in our bodies, so this, you know, this all is interrelated with the embodiment piece that I started with here. It's all the same thing. But sometimes what we feel in our bodies isn't actually accurate to the situation. Right. Like, for instance, maybe the man that you're talking about isn't actually angry, but he reminds you of someone in your body, of someone in your past who was not safe.
Right.
And so I would say, then maybe
it's like triggering an alarm inside of me. Like,
exactly.
like an old, like, I think oftentimes too, these are old stories that we develop as children to explain and feel a little bit more control over what is not controllable.
Yes.
And so those stories just kind of come up, even though it may have absolutely nothing to do with what is happening in the present situation. Like, I know for myself, I feel hijacked. Yes. Like, I feel literally like I just got pulled out of my, whatever the reality is, and into, you know, something that happened to me when I was a little kid. And even though like a little bit of my rational mind might be saying, like, you know, this just doesn't make sense. This is not happening, but boy, does it feel real.
Yes, exactly. And this is actually really important, because we could look at this situation where your body is reacting to something that's not actually happening in the moment, that's not actually true. And we could be like, see, our bodies aren't to be trusted.
Yeah.
Because the information that they're giving me right now, yeah, I'm hijacked, and it's not true to what's actually right. happening. So I can't trust my body. But I would posit that, yes, you can. Maybe what you're feeling isn't exactly an accurate reflection of what's happening in your environment, but it is giving you really important information. It's saying there's something in this situation that is bringing that even if it's not true to the situation, there's something that needs to be tended.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's like, I really like that. Something needs to be tended. Something needs to be attended to.
And that's like important that. Information.
Yeah.
And that's accurate information, in that something is coming up that needs some tend, that needs some care, that needs some love. And so we can back out, like, what's actually happening here? And if we are having if our external environment is activating unresolved trauma in us versus being actually a threatening situation, then we can go work with that unresolved trauma. It gives us a doorway, an opening into some healing that needs to happen. And then as that resolves, then we can return to that same experience and be like, what's changed?
Yeah.
Am I activated again? Or am I now, you know, can I be in the situation in a different way?
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to stop here and also just give a word of praise to you and to many, the many other healers and practitioners I've known in my life, because the healing piece in particular, I think it's really valuable. Like, sometimes somebody might say, like, it's really important, like, speak to a therapist, and that might be one way to do it. But I do feel that, you know, old trauma that has not been witnessed and loved and healed is a delicate thing. It's powerful. It's super powerful. It really runs all of us in ways that we, you know, if you're not paying attention, I mean, so much of the way we act in the world might just be us responding to like an old trauma, and it doesn't have much to do with what's even happening. So it's really important to have, this is the work that you do, this is the work other practitioners do, but it's so valuable to have another person who can create some space, create a safe container, and help you address it. Because the whole reason that you've got that trauma there is because you've never had a safe place to address it.
Exactly.
So I'm just giving a plug or a promo, like just promoting, if anybody's listening to this and saying, I totally feel that, you know, this is so true for me. You know, I really encourage you to find somebody, you know, who can really help you with that. Cause it really isn't something you should try to do by yourself.
Oh yes. Having that witness and that person who can hold the space is so
really important. Yeah. It's really, really important. So, thank you, Larissa. This was great. You know,
can
as
I
we're coming
in here,
please.
Sure. Thank you. Just that. So my premise here still is that even when our bodies are not responding accurately, perhaps to what's happening in our environment, they can still be trusted because they are still giving us information.
Yes.
It's just information that there's some healing that needs to happen.
Yes.
And then the more that we can bring healing to that trauma, the more that we can dismantle these various smokestacks that are adding to the fog and the trauma around us, the more clear our bodies become, and the more they then accurately reflect what's happening in our environment. And so then, mm-hmm. If we're no longer being triggered by unresolved trauma out of a experience with somebody who was angry in our past, and we come to a person who actually is holding unresolved, holding a lot of anger, even if they aren't showing it, even if that's not what they're expressing in the moment, and our bodies feel that, we're going to know that that's an accurate reflection of what's happening in the moment. Did that make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes perfect sense.
It makes perfect sense. Thank you for letting me finish that thought.
No, not at all. I mean, we really could. There's so many places we could go with this. I want to thank you again for your time and your wisdom and your expertise and all the things that you bring to your work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larissa.